Good morning, everybody. It is February 23rd, 2024. Today, I am joined in our podcast, Tales from the Heart, with our good friend, Steve Ahman from the Mayo Clinic. And we're going to talk a little bit about raising awareness about HCM. And we're going to talk about HCM Awareness Day. And this thing behind me here, my pop-up that I brought in from the office, or Stacy dropped off for me. Thank you very much, Stacy. HCM Hill Day, our first ever Hill Day, going to Congress and talking in the Rayburn Building to members of the mostly House. We had a couple Senate representatives there as well about the importance of raising awareness about HCM. So, Steve, you joined us in D.C. How was your adventure to D.C.?
It's always interesting to see the lives of other people at work, I have to say.
That's a really interesting perspective. It's a unique set of individuals who work on the Capitol.
You know, we have meetings and you go meet a staffer and you know they're basically human filters because their senator or congressman is so busy with requests from constituents and whatnot that you know that they're there to just basically be a filter and identify things that needs to pass through. And it's a very interesting life.
I want to just let everybody know what our Hill Day looked like. It was the first one we've ever done. We hope to do them annually. So we had about 40 individuals, volunteers, member of industry, physicians, come join us on the Hill. We walked to all the House offices, some of the Senate offices. The Senate was not in session while we were there, so we were mostly speaking to House members, and we invited them to a briefing. We did videotape the entire session. You'll be seeing it soon online on YouTube. And we brought in a number of people to talk about their experiences with HCM. But we needed to get all of the members there, or their staff members. So we walked the halls on Valentine's Day, handed out silly candies and invitations, and tried to get them interested in coming to hear our briefing. We did get some good representatives showing up for the briefing. And we also had representative sessions from Texas come and do an introductory talk on one of our key speakers. We brought in Jared Butler, who is an NBA player with HCM, which is very unusual. So we'll talk a little bit about that too. And then we brought in the Blair family to talk about their tragic loss of their daughter, Jillian, to a delay in diagnosis. And then we spoke to Marcia Rosenberg, who is an 81 3/4-year-old woman thriving with HCM. Then you and Marty were given some technical information about disease and prevalence and what genetic heart diseases are. And then we also heard from Deitra DeBose at Atlantic Health on health equity in HCM and Ryan Gausch from Patch about some access to care issues. And we got some really good response. We've already heard back from a number of the offices. They're very interested in helping us with a National HCM Awareness Day. Probably won't be for this year. It'll be for next year. Also looking to question more people in their Welcome to Medicare visit about their heart health, because believe it or not, we don't really ask any questions about it. They suggest you do some blood testing, but that's about it. That was our Hill visit was, and that's how we communicated. And I thought it was an interesting experience. I hope it went as well for the other side as I feel it went on our side. We got lots of kudos from people who've seen many of these and thought we were well-organized, informative, and direct to the point. And we're not asking for money, which is a very unusual thing to do in a briefing, to just say we want to be more careful in the money that we're spending on healthcare. So help us be more precise. What was your take on the actual briefing?
I mean, again, you have to recognize that you always craft a briefing in your message to the audience and the message you're trying to get them to receive. And so a lot of people may have never heard of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So we gave them kind of basics of HCM 101. Marty largely did that part of it, and why it's important to screen for these heart diseases, any well visit exam, but also at the Welcome to Medicare exam, because it doesn't just impact that individual and maybe their subsequent care, but also entire families. And so it's just always different. Every time you talk to a group, you have to understand who you're talking to and kind of what their base level of knowledge is. And you just have to match it to that.
And I think we struck a nice balance. A couple of the staffers came up to me and were really impressed with the manner in which we explained and the simplicity of the ask. It made sense to them. So thankfully, it's bipartisan. So we have support from Republicans and Democrats. They understand that everybody has hearts and that we want to take care of them all. So that was super encouraging in this climate to really see collaborative efforts. I remain cautiously optimistic that there is still some ability in this country to come together on issues that are important to all of us. Maybe I'm a little Pollyanna here and maybe I just want the world to be nicer than it has been in the past, but I got a good vibe out of our visit to the Hill. And I think that there's a possibility for some really important work to be done in the coming months and years. Things don't happen quickly, So this is going to be a multi-year project. So hopefully a number of you can come join us again next year. We learned some things. We're going to organize it a little bit different in the future, but it was a good first attempt. And to those of you who came out and participated, I cannot thank you enough. So Steve, it's Heart Month. We're wrapping up. It's coming to an end, but HCM Awareness Day is next Wednesday. And we will be taking our time to really focus attention on what we've been doing organizationally over the past couple of years and what we're going to be doing in the next year. But why do you think it's important to take the time to recognize the disease on a particular day and use this platform?
The main issue is, even though HCM isn't rare, it's not as common as other diagnoses. And so if you aren't reminded of the fact that HCM exists, can cause very common symptoms, which overlap with a bunch of other disease states and can lead to diagnostic misadventures, or it can be completely asymptomatic, but have implications for that patient's treatment of their other health conditions and or their family. If you don't continue to remind people that this exists and they should be thinking about it, there's a chance that it's missed. That's true for any disease that isn't affecting most people every day, and HCM fits in that category. So I think it's a great idea to have general periodic awareness. You know, we do it, you know, within the medical community at all the, you know, big meetings. There's always sessions on HCM at American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association, European Society of Cardiology. You have your meetings with patients and centers. We have the HCM Summit coming up in the fall, which is bringing worldwide experts around to talk about the disease. So we do it in the medical community, but to put it into an environment that is less centered on care delivery, like just congressional awareness, et cetera, that it's important to fund these things, I think is a noble mission.
And it's a tiring one too, but it's a worthy one. We've been in the game a long time. I'm trying to think the other day, I'm trying to remember when I met you the first time. And I'm thinking it was like 97.
It's 97 to 99, somewhere in that time period, yeah.
It equates to, damn, we're getting old, but that's okay. A little more white around the temples for both of us, but I kind of hide mine. The world has changed so much in those 25 years in HCM. And we're kind of in this catapult era where we're moving really fast with certain things. That's mm-hmm. good and it's concerning. We want to make sure everybody's staying aware of the facts and the science and the evolution. Unbridled enthusiasm, which is probably my favorite line that I've stolen from Rick Nishimura, is dangerous. We have to balance the excitement of new technology with grounding that these are diseases that are going to be chronic, HCM and all of the different various genetic mutations or no genetic mutation identified. It's a long-term disease. How do we elevate the ability for new therapies and balance that with the fact that it's not a cure for most? We have gene therapy in one person so far. We don't know if it worked or not. But these new myosin inhibitors, people are talking about in very boastful words. And we've seen some remarkable improvements in some people, but not everybody. And these are thought to be lifetime drugs. How do we balance excitement with reality?
And that's the challenge. And it's not unique to HCM or medicine. I mean, there's a famous technology thing called the Gartner hype cycle. New idea comes along and it goes through a period of unbridled enthusiasm, followed by a trough of despair where they realize that not everything's as great as it seemed in the early studies and there are some downsides. And then after that, eventually you get to the plain in between those two, the peak and the valley, which is the reality. And that's probably a pretty poor summary of what the hype cycle is, but that's the general concept. And that's the idea. I mean, super excited early on. Whenever we do clinical trials are designed to limit the number of degrees of variables that could affect the outcomes. And so it's a highly selected set of patients who are eligible for trials to show if there's any benefit or not. If there is, then you get to the phase we're in now where mavacamten is being used, quote unquote, in the wild, which means the patients are less controlled. They don't all fit a common template. And so now we're going to start to see some wins and some losses in terms of ultimate effect for this agent. But I do think that it is great that we have these new tools and we should be excited. If we aren't excited about it, then people aren't going to continue to work with us to work for new solutions for our patients. And we have to consider what is success. For some people, all they want is to get a little bit better. Well, I think mavacamten is about 2/3 of patients get at least some better. If you want a home run to where you have almost no symptoms, well, that's down to about 1/3 of patients that take the agent. And so we just need to have that conversation with people so we know what the expectations are and what we're hoping to achieve.
Over the years, you and I have both seen a lot of new things added to the toolbox. Some things are still there.
Yep.
Some things have faded and they're at the bottom of the toolbox and we can grab them if we need them, but they're not mm-hmm. highly useful.
Yep.
I think about 2 months ago, there was a perfect patient for dual chamber pacing for lots of weird reasons. Mm-hmm. That was going to be the best option for that individual. And it's still an option for some.
Yep.
Alcohol ablation in the late 90s, early 2000s, that was going to be the cure. We didn't need to do anything else. Well, not really. It's for some patients. I guess this just validates the thought that a center of excellence is still critically important to identify what tool in the toolbox has the most utility with that individual patient. And the only way you really get to know that as a clinician, from my point of view, is lots of experience with the population. What is Mayo up to in terms of its patient population in the history of the institution? It's got to be 5,000-ish.
It's more than that. But you know, it's a great point. But one of the nice things about having a pharmacologic option beyond beta blockers and calcium channel blockers is that, especially as we get more experience with it just generally, people will be able to try mavacamten with their patients and see, does it make a difference? And if it does, then patients can then maybe come to a center and say, gosh, I don't know whether I want to take this drug for the rest of my life, or would surgery be able to accomplish the same thing? Or would an ablation be able to serve the same thing? So it's the barrier to entry for a patient getting onto an advanced option is going to be lower now that we have these pharmacologic options. Yes, there are challenges, but you know, I mean, the way it was proved by the FDA, there's lots of guardrails around its use that means that people are, it's in the sake of safety. At Mayo, we have a lot of patients on cardiac myosin inhibitor right now, both clinically and on some of the ongoing trials that are there. But we still do more operations than we do new starts of mavacamten. And that might be, again, for some of your audience, there's something called referral bias. And that means people come to us because we do so well at these other things. And so the people that come to us have already kind of declared, I don't want to be on medications, or I don't tolerate medications, or the medications didn't work. So our patient population is a little bit overrepresented by people who are more inclined to have surgery by the time they see us. I specifically go over all of the options, disopyramide, mavacamten, ablation, myectomy, with everyone who is failed or failing first-line therapies.
That's, I think, the best way to do it. And then we get into this conversation of shared decision-making, which allows the patient to engage in a conversation about what meets my needs, what do I want to do, what's available for me to do. I think that really speaks to why it's critically important that this patient population take the time to get educated from multiple sources. They can come to the HCMA here, perspective here, get some resources, go to a center, hear what the clinician is offering them, and make sure that they understand that it's not just, here's a therapy, go away, and you're fine, that there's options, and that it's not a forever destination. It may change over time. It may be good for now. It may change later. I think we are starting to get a really good cadence of helping that patient get educated with one of our center partners, and then they can process the information and make their choices. I spoke to a family yesterday. We recorded them for HCM Awareness Day, and they're sharing their story of the child's diagnosis, the father's diagnosis, first not wanting a defibrillator because it was, you know, optional. And then they realized, yeah, it's optional, but here are the risk factors and here's what's at risk and here's the solution. And they all agreed that the defibrillator is the right move and it's getting done in 2 weeks. But it took them a while to get there. We're working with a couple of our partners to identify ways to get to the newly diagnosed earlier before they make critical treatment decisions, because sometimes the community cardiologists get scared of HCM and they put in devices when there's no real risk factors. It's just the disease. And we don't want people to have therapies that they don't need. We want them to have the right ones at the right time for the right reason. So taking a moment and getting expert advice. Mayo Clinic offers virtual clinic visits at this point, correct?
Yes.
Somebody who's diagnosed in Connecticut and they want a second opinion, they don't necessarily have to get on an airplane and go to Mayo Clinic to get it. They can do a virtual visit. How are those working for you guys?
It is still somewhat of a complicated landscape. So essentially, providers are not supposed to give medical care or treatment advice to patients if they are in a state where that provider is not licensed. We'll use your example of Connecticut. I'm not licensed in Connecticut. So I shouldn't get on a video with a patient and say, gosh, you know, you probably should increase your metoprolol to 50 milligrams and give me a call in 2 weeks, and then we'll decide where we want to go from there. That would be outside the bounds of practicing across state lines, which we shouldn't do. We can, however, talk to patients and say, you know, in general, patients like you, we have found that often medications aren't going to do it for you, and we might need to consider more advanced options. But in order to go get into the details of that, I'm going to need you to travel. Or, gosh, no, everything is right. You don't need to travel to Mayo at all. So we can kind of give advice about whether we think it would be worth their while to travel or not. If I am licensed in the state where they are, which I've got about half the country covered, then I can do just like what the first visit is if you came to Mayo, only with the testing they've had locally. And then we can decide, gosh, yes, that it looks like there's an opportunity here for us to do A or B. We're going to come in, we're going to do a limited number of tests when you get here. We're going to have both option A and B set up for you, so it's a one-time visit and we can get it done. We're using that quite a bit for our patients. It is still limited post-pandemic by state licensure rules, which were kind of relaxed during COVID so people could get care at all. Now the states are more interested in making sure that we're not doing something that we're not supposed to do. I can also get on my soapbox and tell you how ridiculous it is that we do that. So my Minnesota driver's license applies around the world. I can drive a car anywhere in the world. I can tell you I'm much more qualified to practice HCM in Manhattan than I am to drive a car in downtown Manhattan. But, you know, that's just the way things work.
I got you. I'll drive you in Manhattan. I think it's like a game. But I think you're right. This kind of goes back to why it's important for us as an organization to have a relationship with Capitol Hill and start working on that federal level, because these rules are silly. They are silly. You are a competent physician with 30 years almost experience in this field. Whether you carry a medical license in Connecticut versus maybe you have one in New York and it's a bordering state, that's not really what matters to a patient.
Right.
What matters to a patient is you are a nationally, internationally known expert in a disease state, but you can't talk to certain people from certain states because you don't have a piece of paper.
Right.
We need reciprocity. We need to have some reciprocity in the law. You can do what you do, and we can help patients find you in a much more efficient manner and be better consumers of healthcare product. It's a big problem. You know, we've now provided the Lori Fund, which gives people $600 a year in travel funds that if they are low income and they need to get to someplace, we want to remove those barriers and we want to get them to where you need to be. And I think it makes sense to do as much through virtual medicine or virtual telehealth versus telemedicine. And I know there's some nuanced differences between those terms, but I think we got to do better. And I think we have to explain why it's critically important, especially having ill cardiac patients, having to travel extensive distances to get a consult on their care, which traveling is exhausting to anybody. And if you're a symptomatic patient with HCM, you're like, no, I'm good. I'm going to stay with my local doctor because I'm just too tired. I can't go there. Mm-hmm. So we have to make it more available for people. I love that battle cry. I want to talk for a minute about current events. I did not prep this. If you don't want to comment, I'm perfectly fine with it, but I'm going to go on a little bit of a rant here. Alabama. For those of you living under a rock right now, let me inform you of a couple little things that are going on. And I'm going to bring up the A word because I know it's controversial. And I know there are people who have very specific religious concerns about the use of abortion. And I know that this is a complicated personal decision for women and families all over the country. But when Roe v. Wade was overturned, I said publicly, they're going to go after IVF next. And courts in Alabama have decided that embryos created through IVF now have personhood. One method of stopping HCM within families is to use pre-implantation genetic diagnostics, which requires IVF to stop a disease. And we have many families who have used IVF either for fertility issues or for stopping the HCM gene from passing to the next generation. It is truly the only way to stop HCM in a family. If we're going to do gene therapies do not impact the reproductive system and do not change the offspring. They only stop the disease in that individual. So the only way we have to stop disease is IVF and PGD. And it has been politicized and it has been vilified. And now these families in Alabama need to remove their embryos from the state as soon as possible, if they can. We don't know what's going to happen with them. And this is not logical. This is not about a questionable, I think you should have had an abortion. I don't think you should have. These are people trying to start a family free of disease that have now been stopped from doing so unless they're willing to implant the embryos that carry the disease. Steve, do you have any thoughts on this?
I do. It's obviously a complicated situation. And as you said, it's been politicized and it's in a way that creates more polarity amongst people who have differing opinions rather than trying to find convergence. It just causes more emotions to get involved and less direct dialogue on solutions. But yeah, it's an issue. And I have my own thoughts about it, which are not the way things are going. But yeah, it's an important discussion we need to have, because like you say, it's important to these families. It's important to everyone with these diseases. I wish there were easy answers, but obviously there aren't.
It's so disappointing to see such advances in science and then see policies that cut them off at the knees and just stop them. And yeah, they're sharing some links right now. Yep. About a family. Yep. Who has used a PGD and IVF for the creation of their child. We have many of these stories. Some of them are public about their experience and some of them are private. And I'm going to go back about 7 years or so. It might have been right after my transplant. A mother of an adult child called me and said her kids were considering PGD and she's Catholic and she doesn't believe in abortion and she didn't know where IVF fit in all of that. And we had a good conversation. I talked about what the science was. I talked about how to understand what the procedure was and that it was a grouping of 10 cells typically that they would test and they would either discard or they would implant. And after about 40 minutes, this woman who started the conversation, "I'm a Catholic. I don't believe in abortion." I'm like, "Okay, completely understand. We can still have a conversation about this. Here's the facts." She said, "Science is," this was her words, and I've always been struck by them. "Science was created by God. God created the technology to stop suffering, and my family has an opportunity to use that science to create a healthier child. That's beautiful. I'm for it now." And it was a 45-minute conversation. And she understood, and she then became supportive of her children who were going to have children this way. I think once you understand that we've spent billions of dollars on the Human Genome Project, we now understand the mechanism of some genetic diseases and we can stop them. Isn't that what this is all about? Improving quality of life? We need to get there. We need to get there. So again, we need to have conversations that are going to be hard. Didn't really mean to go down the abortion hole there, but I think it's important that we talk about it openly and honestly. And I'm only talking about the IVF and PGD part of it right now. We have other stories about medically necessary abortions in complicated HCM patients that otherwise would have spontaneously aborted and bled out because of anticoagulation and all kinds of other complicating medical factors that are tragic. They are tragic moments in somebody's life, and they're being politicized. And I'm really concerned about the future for these families. I'm going to put that one in a little box and put it aside. I may do a little rant later on my own personal Facebook page on that one. Understanding the diseases that we're talking about and the hopes of science, it's absolutely amazing. Such an ethical dilemma. My son is HCM. I wouldn't change him for the world. He lives a good life under great care. My mom passed away at 36 due to obstructive HCM. Neither would be here today if we have unselected and silenced in this way. You're 100% right. You are definitively correct. We are not saying that we don't want people with HCM to be here, but if we could stop the suffering of a family by ending the disease, some families may find that that's the option for them. And you may decide it's not the option for you. I'm all about options, treatment options, family planning options, care options. It's not mine to take away somebody else's options. And it's not theirs to take away mine. That's the way I view the world. Options should be available. Gemma, thank you so much for that comment. And I really do appreciate you sharing that. And I 100% back you. If that's what's right for you, you go, girl. And that's right for your family or your son, great. But don't take away somebody else's options. Now that we're back on HCM topics, and we'll put that one aside. What's coming in 2024 for patients with HCM that shows promise?
The pivotal change was really several years ago when the first work that became mavacamten started, and the pharmaceutical companies started paying attention to some of the mechanisms of HCM, which has not only led to mavacamten, but now there's several other, more in that class, but now in other classes of medications in development and drug companies, when before HCM just wasn't on any of the company's radars in terms of drug development. So that continues to be the pivotal thing. And you mentioned it before, there's trials of gene-specific therapy. And these initial trials aren't about whether they are going to cure the disease or not. The first trials are just, can we safely deliver this thing and not make the patient sicker in some way? And it's a very complicated, regulated, the review the patient has to go through and understanding for informed consent is super rigorous. But that has started. I don't know that I personally think that gene therapy is going to take care of the biggest bucket of HCM patients. But the more tools we have available to us, to your point earlier, that means more patients are going to have options amongst those tools that meet their specific genetic code or their specific anatomy or their personal goals and desires for themselves in terms of what they want. Just this renewed interest is there. The other thing that is closely coupled with that, which has been super important in the world of HCM, is the number of younger cardiologists who have a real interest in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and are really trying to push this science forward and establish programs in more places. There's a large pool of very smart, eager cardiologists who are entering the arena, so to speak, that is just giving patients options. Again, more local expertise for more patients is helpful.
We're doing a lot of different type of work in the office lately, and we've been involved with a lot of the pharma companies doing like patient focus groups. Some of them is more like market research related, like they want to understand us so they know how to talk to us. But there might be a role to put together some patient focus groups for cardiology fellows who are thinking about getting into HCM and hearing from patients in a different way rather than that clinical experience. Maybe we should create something where we can bring some of the early career people together with groups of patients in a different way of having a dialogue rather than that clinical experience. Some focus groups or something. I want them to understand us sooner. This new generation that's coming up right now, they are more in tune with technology and different ways of communicating. They're teaching me a thing or two. So maybe there's a way that we can get them in earlier and get them a little bit more excited. I can remember my earliest thoughts of putting together our annual meeting were related to, I want you guys on the clinical side to not only take care of us, but I want you to like us. I want you to understand us. I want to develop personal relationships as well as professional ones. And I think that's worked quite well for us, but let's get this next generation embedded early and understand the needs of the community so they don't fall into some of the myths that are out there, like fatigue doesn't come from HCM or chest pain in HCM isn't a real thing. Yeah, it is. It's a thing. We all know it. I don't need any more ideas. I have a lot of them, but that's actually one that I like. Back in the 90s, drew a picture of a pyramid. In my experience, it wasn't going to do us any good to go out and start screaming outside, do you have HCM? When we didn't have any place for these people to get care. Mm-hmm. Competent care. There was so few providers back then. Now we have a big network. We have a way to get people to their community cardiologists, to experts in HCM if the community cardiologist needs more help. And we have a pipeline that's working throughout the country. There's these hub and spoke models that we've been developing for 25 years, and we're here now. Part of HCM Awareness Day is to ensure that people understand the path to care and that it's accessible to them, and that we can not only diagnose you, which is not something that everybody wants to be diagnosed with a disease or a condition, but there's so much we can do for them today. So now we're finally at the bottom of that pyramid, which was community awareness. And the middle was healthcare providers, you know, GPs, cardiologists, and then the specialists. We are at a point where it's time. We can talk to the masses now. We have bandwidth. We can provide life-changing care to many families. And it's time to start getting out on the streets and talking more about HCM in the communities, which is why we set up our ambassador program. And we're going to be adding new ambassadors to the ambassador program. And we're going to try to get out in different ways to talk about HCM in different communities. We're doing a community event in April with our local town, the offices in Denville, where we're going to be doing a drill Dr. Hart with all of the volunteer coaches and teaching them things and teaching volunteers how to go train other people on how to do this. So there's a lot more community work going on now because people are starting to understand us better. I gave testimony to the Oregon Senate, but we're getting state houses involved. We're getting Capitol Hill involved. We're getting more advocates involved. We're doing more to raise awareness. Do you think this is the right strategy? Should we alter our strategy? Is the world ready to hear about this in bigger ways?
I think the strategy and tactics are good. I mean, I think that going to the Capitol Hill and looking at federal issues is needed. But I mean, to your point about licensure, the federal government really has shown no interest in messing with state by state licensure. That's part of states' rights, and the states aren't going to be super interested in giving that up because it's a revenue stream for states. It's not a big revenue stream, but it's some revenue for states to legislate this locally. But that's part of our country. There are state by state issues and there are federal issues. And so we're going to have to hit all of those fronts. Going back to the 90s, when you first started HCMA, it was raising awareness for patients. It was raising awareness for cardiologists, and it's kind of coalesced more and more. And I think we have a big network of people with experience with HCM beyond what you get in basic training, and figuring the best way amongst those experts to leverage one another when needed. We have people from other top HCM centers who we talk back and forth about patients, send patients to each other, and not falling into the trap that because you reach some level of excellence or competence in HCM, it doesn't mean that you don't also leverage the rest of the network for the benefit of your patients. And so it's a constant learning and an ebb and flow and those types of things.
I'm really glad that you brought up the collaborative nature. It wasn't always that way, and it took a long time to get there. And there's still some work that needs to be done, in my opinion. But I think we understand that there's no lack of patients. Nobody's going out of business, unfortunately. I wish that were the case. But there's such knowledge. I know you have probably a whole bunch of patients in your head that were these unique, weird, they did this, not that scenarios. We aren't all from a cookie cutter. We're going to have some differences. But when you've seen something different and you remember it, it may not be a case report, you may not have published it, but you know it, and somebody else knows that this happened to you, they can lean into your experience. Yeah. It may not be the perfect answer because there's not enough data. You only have an N of one. But if you take those experiences and you share them collectively with this really wonderful community that we've all worked to pull together, that's a bit unique in healthcare. It does exist in other subspecialties where there's these networks of experts that are communicating across institutions. But within cardiology, there's not a lot of them. It's the, you know, the Danon's kids, or, you know, maybe some odd anatomic, you know, difference in the congenital world that they know about. The multiple variations that could occur with somebody with HCM. Every time you think to yourself, I've seen it all, don't say that. That's a curse word, right?
Yep.
Because I've talked to over 20,000 families with HCM from 100 different countries. I've only seen a couple that look exactly alike. And I would guess that that would be your experience as well.
Every HCM presentation in 2000 to 2010 had the word heterogeneous in it, meaning there isn't a cookie cutter template of what HCM looks like in an individual or a family. I think the word got overused, and so people aren't saying it as much anymore, but it remains true. HCM hearts are not the same. You just got to recognize that. And the way it impacts families is not the same. Even within a family, as you can attest, some family members with HCM do better than others or have completely different flavors of HCM within one nuclear family. So it's not just a straightforward recipe that you follow to take care of patients.
One thing is for sure, that nothing is for sure. It's all variable. I think this community is the patient community. As they come in, they think it's all one thing. They all have the same disease. But then after a couple of weeks of doing some education, they realize that the nuances are very different. Our Facebook community, I think, is hitting a new milestone. I think we just hit 11,000. Where we're right on the cusp of 11,000 in our private discussion group. Ain't so private when you get 11,000 people in a room, but it doesn't show up on your feed. So you can have conversations that, you know, your boss or your neighbor isn't seeing. It's sequestered over there. It's been an amazing resource for patients to see that there's variety of disease and that they are not alone, that they all feel just a little bit unique, and they are. But they have some camaraderie, and they don't feel so alone when they come together in these virtual ways. So We're going to keep doing that. We're going to keep doing this. We're going to keep doing the thing behind me. That was the banner that we used for HCM Awareness Day behind us at the Hill. And we're going to keep talking to interesting people. You know, we brought Jared Butler with us to Capitol Hill. I would not say Jared is mainstream HCM. He's a professional athlete who is diagnosed, who has gotten a treatment plan together with experts, consulted with multiple experts, got some diversity and opinion on what to do through shared decision making and through making sure he is safe. He made choices and he's playing in the NBA. He's not normal, but he is possible. Can we talk about how we have evolved our understanding of exercise in HCM and where we are in that process? 15 years ago, we would say, sorry,
yeah,
NBA career not for you. Why has it changed?
So it's changed because we in the HCM community have gathered more information. The story was Dr. Marin did an investigation of athletes who had died and found out that HCM was overrepresented amongst those dead athletes, mm-hmm. which tells you at baseline that it is higher risk to be an athlete with HCM than an athlete without HCM.
Completely.
It doesn't tell you the magnitude of that risk. It just tells you that there is excess risk there. And so cardiology community, the HCM community, erred on the side of, well, let's just keep these people safe and we'll tell them they can't participate in competitive athletics, which unfortunately traveled downstream to the point where we were telling HCM patients they can't be active, which was a complete disservice to a large number of patients, because having metabolic syndrome because you're out of shape and have type 2 diabetes and all those kind of things, plus HCM, is probably higher risk than being an athlete with HCM. But newer thought leaders, newer HCM experts coming in and asking questions in a different way. And so, well, why don't we look at living HCM patients and see amongst the various levels of activity, are we seeing a threshold where the risk goes up? And the answer is no. It doesn't look like among people who are most vigorous as self-reported, or if we're using exercise trackers or those kind of things, have higher risk than less active individuals. It doesn't tell us there's no risk, though. What that tells us is fact A is still true. HCM is overrepresented amongst people who have died, who are athletic. It tells us the magnitude of risk. If you're a patient with HCM and choose to be athletic, that risk is small enough that our studies haven't been big enough to tell it, to identify it statistically. So we've come to an era where now you don't get to choose whether you have HCM or not. But if you have HCM, you get to choose whether you want to have an active lifestyle or in extreme cases, be a competitive athlete. And that's what the role of the center and the person who is an expert in HCM, who also deals with athletes, to understand the type of stress they put on their bodies to be competitive at that level and have a conversation about that, acknowledging that there is some increased risk, that we can't measure that risk, we can't predict that risk. But ultimately, we have moved away from an era of being dogmatic and just saying, no, you can't play because you have HCM, to here's what you need to know. You may choose to play and here's what you need to know about the potential for risk. And for some individuals and some families, they want to choose that and they accept that risk. And then we work with them to make sure that their team has the right kind of emergency action plan. There's AEDs at the practice and game facilities and all those kind of things to be as safe as possible for that individual. What that doesn't mean, though, is that I can make the University of X accept you as a player because you have HCM. I can allow you as a player to find someplace that will let you play, but I can't make an individual team accept you. It's the same thing if you have an orthopedic injury. If you have a chronic shoulder injury, certain NFL teams will not take that person as their quarterback. Think about Drew Brees. The Miami Dolphins chose not to sign Drew Brees to a contract because he had a shoulder injury, even though his doctors had cleared and the doctors couldn't make the Dolphins take him. The Saints decided to take him, and he had a pretty good career in New Orleans. It can be a similar thing with HCM. Some teams are going to say, no, that's just not in the profile of what how we're building our team and our structure. We appreciate your autonomy to make a decision. There might be another team that's willing to take you. It is a very complicated discussion with the patient regarding the nuances of that risk. The fact that we can't measure it or predict it, that we have some measures to mitigate the risk, but not completely eliminate them. And then the vagaries of finding a team, school, if you want to continue to play. And Jared tells a beautiful story last week about how he made that decision. I've had other athletes that were from the prior era who, you know, were told they couldn't play, who have also pivoted to very successful careers in and out of sports. So there's pathways for these individuals, but it is, again, it's individual. It's about understanding the goals and motivations of the individual patient and giving them information so that they're making informed decisions about what they want to do.
Another piece, and I've been talking about this quite a bit the past few months, just because there's been a culture shift. When I was diagnosed in 1980, like, sit down, shut up, don't do anything. You could die at any moment. You're a ticking time bomb. These are words that were spoken to me. And that wasn't true. Necessarily, it was what they thought in 1980. Things evolved. When you look at the sudden death in athletes registry and similar data sets, these were undiagnosed individuals for the most part. And they're diagnosed on autopsy or after an arrest. We're talking about people who know their disease, who are going for care, that are being compliant patients, and they're taking an active role in their healthcare, and they're identified. Big difference from the unidentified. It's important to get the unidentified through things like pre-participation screening physicals, listening for murmurs, looking at family history, looking at symptoms of the young person, and getting to diagnosis as early as possible. This is why we have the Healthy Cardiac Monitoring Act on the state level. It improves student-athlete participation physicals. It provides education to community doctors who are doing these screenings. And it also adds those same components to the well-child exam. We're trying to be systematic and sustainable. And if we can find people, we can assess risk and we can take care of that and mitigate the risk and allow them to be part of shared decision making. Not everybody with HCM is going to be able to get diagnosed and go ahead and be a competitive athlete because maybe they have some severe obstruction, which will hurt them. And maybe they need to mitigate the obstruction before they go ahead and continue with sports. So it's not a definitely yes, you can. And it's not a definitely no, you can't. It's let's figure you out and get you to the right answer. And that's a really big advance. For some people, it was a deterrent to diagnosis. Well, I don't want to know. I feel fine. I don't think it's a problem. You can mitigate risk and you can take care of yourself and live the kind of life that you want to live. In closing today, thank you very much. That was a really good explanation of that topic. So I want to close out today, and Teresa's commenting again, love part of the shared decision-making process. So remember when my son was a teen, he was told to do very little physical activity because that's what we thought was safe at the time, and we've evolved.
Yeah, the recommendations are now that patients try to get the same physical activity that the rest of us are supposed to get, mild to moderate intensity cardio, including some strength training as well. And if we can't achieve that, then that's the goal of using more therapies to eliminate symptoms so that people can get all the benefits, physical and mental, of being physically active.
And I think that is absolutely wonderful. But some of us were brought up in a generation where we were given misinformation. It was information that was appropriate for the time and the understanding. But those myths are now going through the family tree when other people get diagnosed. This is what I was told. It's time to hit the reset button for some families and go back and get new assessments and hear current thinking and help them get as active as they can possibly be. Following the theme of the month, it's HCM Awareness Day coming up next week. I'm hoping that this cough and this congestion and this COVID will be gone by next Wednesday night when we are going to be doing our State of the Union. I'm going to give you a little State of the Union on the activities at the HCMA. We're going to talk about 2024 updates in HCM care and management. We're going to feature some very inspirational stories. We're going to hear from our ambassadors. You're going to hear about our legislative initiatives. If you show up for one session to hear what's going on in the HCM world, this is the one. It's next Wednesday night. You can sign up online now, but we hope that you come and join us. And again, to all the volunteers who came to the Hill with us, thank you so much. We learned a lot. You were great. It was an extraordinary event. Oh, and look for us on Wizards television show. The Washington Wizards came and they recorded some of Jared's comments and they did some sideline interviews. My favorite picture of the day is professional NBA player Jared standing next to Marsha, who is 81 and 3/4 and a QVC model. She is a small, fair-skinned, gray-haired white woman from the suburbs of Pennsylvania. And there is Jared from Louisiana and Texas playing in Washington, D.C. as an African-American basketball player, and they are shared in heart. And it's a great picture, and it's my favorite one of the day because it shows that the faces of HCM are very diverse. They are young, they are old. You can live to old age with HCM, and our goal and our hope is to help you to get there as healthy as possible. Steve, thank you again for joining us on Tales from the Heart, and we look forward to seeing you all next week at HCM Awareness Day. Thank you all, and have a great day.